I don't know a lot about entomology, but I know insect populations are at risk. Is that right?
There's just been a huge reduction in the global population of insects, and insects are essential to global ecology in a very deep way. And so there's, that's a lot of environmental pieces deal with that sort of apocalyptic, like world-threatening stuff. And we wanted to touch on that and acknowledge that. But Susie in particular was concerned that like all the gloom and doom people hear about environmental stuff is like the diminishing returns on the message. And so she also wanted to make sure that we celebrated insects and that we were made them interesting and exciting and didn't just didn't tell tell that tale of the impending destruction. But it is important. I mean, when you just drive across the country, when we used to go on tour from one city to another, your windshield would be covered with dead insects and you'd have to clean it off at the gas station or wherever. And now you pull in and your windshield's just fine. So just anecdotally, you can see clear evidence of population decline, as well as native insects to various areas declining. Like we have mosquitoes, like a ton of mosquitoes here in Austin, but both the mosquitoes that bite humans and that are driving people crazy are invasive species that got brought when humans came and or even more recently, one came 50 years ago. Like I can't remember from where. Same thing with the cockroaches we have, that et cetera. There are various we have a army like red ants aggressive population here that's sort of throughout the southeastern United States has been growing, growing, growing. And those are not native ants, but they take over. And so there's a long list of these sort of environmental dominoes that are happening through the insect world.
I can kind of wrap my mind around how you try to recover the population for bald eagles or bears or something, right?
Right.
Breed them and everything. But how do you do that with insects? Like, I mean, is there any kind of plans or thoughts on this?
There are many plans and thoughts, and but some of them are simple. Like when we have all our bright lights in a city, especially, you take away night insects' ecosystems. And so a lot of cities are already doing this. They're either encouraging turning lights off at night, they're making the street lights a little dimmer. I mean, there's a safety issue on the human side, so trying to balance that. But people are encouraged not to leave their porch lights on anymore. And so light pollution is one big one, for example, that city governments especially have really actually been enacting and trying to address. I think that you range from micro solutions to macro solutions, and there's so many different kinds of insects, like there's no one size fits all solution in at all. The number of insects in the world species are anywhere from 5 to 50 million kinds of insects, and only 1 million of them, or a couple million of them maybe, have been identified. So we haven't even identified all the insects, never mind figured out what makes them happy, what makes them sad, and how do you make sure their population holds up. But there's a lot of work being done on it. It doesn't in people don't like insects, so it's hard to get a splash. It's not pandas, where you can say save the pandas and everybody's on board. Say save the insects, everybody's like, wait, why would we do that? So there's a marketing challenge as well to the issue.
Yeah, for sure. I think though, when you talk about, I mean, everybody can wrap their mind around the global ecology, like that's, I mean, we know how delicate and fragile it is, and where we're starting
Yes.
to learn anyway, and how much we're negatively impacting it because humans are everywhere,
Yeah, exactly.
requires so much. I mean,
Yeah.
one human, has just a mountain of crap that trails
The
behind.
resources humans require is intense, and for global ecology, humans are not necessary. Like the, if you take, we noticed during the pandemic, you take away humans and all of a sudden nature thrives. And that is not the case with insects. You take away insects and everything crumbles. They're vital globally in every ecosystem for the health of that ecosystem.
Welcome to Relevant Tones. I'm Seth Bosted. I opened the program with the first track of a new album created by Graham Reynolds, Susie Ibarra, and Jeffrey Ziegler called Insectum. And I have the good fortune of having Graham Reynolds as the guest on the program today to talk about Insectum, and a little later we'll also talk about another project called Music for Profit. But let's get back to Insectum and find out how this project came about.
I was looking for a subject to dive into for a project, and I found Maria Sibylla Marion, who's an amazing scientist and painter, entomologist from the late 1600s. And read her biography, got her art books, really fascinating figure. And that led me deeper into entomology generally. And then the other starting point is Jeffrey Ziegler and I had done this project, Sound of Science, and we were trying to figure out what to do together next. So I proposed this insect entomology thing, and he said yes. And so then we wanted to add one more voice to the artistic voice to the project. And so we asked Susie Ibarra if she would do it, and she said yes. And she does a lot of science and environmental justice work with her composition as well. So it was a pretty natural fit. And then we were off and running. And then we had, I audited a an entomology class here at UT Austin and got to know these two entomologists, husband and wife, that are both entomologists. And they came on board as sort of consultants, advisors, and sort of gave us a lot of feedback the whole time through the process.
Thank you.
Let's talk about it musically. How did you split it up? How did you work together?
So this was mostly a pandemic project, and that we were all in our different spaces. Jeffrey in Brooklyn, Susie in upstate New York, and me in Texas. And so we each just started making stuff, sketches, ideas, and then sending it to each other. And then either adding a layer or putting effects on it or doing whatever we wanted with it and then sending it back. And so it was a back and forth collaborative process. As things started to open up, it felt like we weren't quite there. And then so we all met in New York and went to National Sawdust and spent a day recording there. So we had that one day it all in the room together. And then I came back to Texas and sort of layered in our in the room recordings with our studio pandemic projects and created the album from there.
And then, I mean, how is it structured? A meadow wakes up all the way through to night insects. Did you, I mean, is there a kind of, narrative or how did you structure it?
That you've already hit on like the only looser frame of a narrative. The rest of it's more on the pacing of the music itself as far as sequencing. I like to do this in general. A lot of people like to do this where you overmake and then you edit down to what works. So there are tracks that we all liked that didn't make it to the album because they didn't fit into the arc that we ended up creating with the sequence. But from the beginning, we knew we wanted a listenable length. Even if we liked tracks, we didn't want it to be an 80-minute long album or something like that. We wanted something in the range of 30 minutes. I've found that, 28-minute albums, old school albums are so much easier to listen to the whole album and get that feeling and that experience because vinyl restricted you to how long it could be. Unless you were going to do double vinyl, you had a limited amount of space you could do on each side. So you didn't end up with 50, 60, 70-minute albums like that. CDs opened up, and now with digital distribution, you can make your album as long as you want to, really. But we wanted something more contained than that. And so once we had these two frames, The Meadow Wakes Up and The Night Insects, it was taking what we had and seeing what worked together in a sequence to make in a prop. I can't remember what our actual runtime ended up being exactly, but something that where it made sense in that 30-minute range.
So, how did you choose the insects that would be featured?
Think each of us, since we were working in separate rooms, separate states, everybody had different ways of starting. One of our entomologists that we were working with specializes in ants. So ants seemed like an easy one because we had an expert in the room. A few of the other ones, the mosquitoes. It was easy also to get sample sets where, every film, not every film, but film sound effects sets have insect sounds, but they're the classics. They're, maybe cicadas, mosquitoes, flies, bees, nothing obscures in those. And so, but I wanted some of it where we were actually playing samples of, so that was, we started a few of them with sound samples. Others would pull up a YouTube video and just do a score to a YouTube video of insects. And so each one had sort of a separate starting point. And I think Jeffrey and Susie and I, every track almost had a different starting point, both because one person started each one, and then how that person chose to start that particular track. But I think it was whatever was grabbing people at the time. Then a few also came from the entomologist hearing our early sketches and telling us what insects they reminded them of. Even if we were thinking in a different direction, their feedback would guide us towards something that made sense to them sonically.
You write the music first. They tell you what insects it makes them think.
Yeah, that was like there were a couple that yeah, it's we've done it every which way. And so and sometimes you're making it, you don't necessarily remember where your starting point was by the end.
Yeah, you kind of touched on my next question, but what were the other sound sources that you all were using and manipulating?
So I have a bunch of film sound effects libraries. So I pulled from those. And I like approaching different tracks, starting in different places. Like I like Omnisphere, soft synth. I like sitting at the piano and it's just all acoustic. I like starting with drums. So another one was Susie has on Splice has sample sets that she's created of her drums and her cymbals and her gongs. So I pulled those down and I started building beats and layers with Susie's own sounds, but Susie wasn't playing them. So in the show, we have Susie playing an extra layer on top of herself, essentially. But it's herself as I've set it up into a beat or a sequence. So Susie sound samples, cinematic sound samples, just starting acoustically. There are a bunch of different ways we started sonically. I've never had a lot of trouble with sort of getting in the zone. And so that like, I have plenty of weaknesses and plenty of things I have to watch out for, but like switching and diving into a project, switching gears, that's not, I don't find that stressful or super hard. I mean, I read every morning, I take mental breaks. But I mean, I always found it helpful when, you know, you get stuck on a project to do something else and then come back to it and you're fresh. And so having the multiple projects just allows you to keep working, but also do that refresh on the other project.
I had one teacher who wasn't my best composition teacher, but she said one thing that has really stuck with me, which is, you know, when you're ending a writing session, don't write yourself out. Like leave a little bit for you to start
yes.
the next time.
Yeah, who I think that's Hemingway, right?
Oh, really? Oh, was she quoting somebody?
I think that's Hemingway. Where you don't you stop when you know what's going to happen next, or you write the first paragraph of the next chapter or something like that. There's some sort of system so you don't come and you're cold. You come and you can just jump right back in.
Yeah, I think that works musically as well, though, you know.
Yeah, I totally agree.
Yeah,
it's a fun, that's good advice, I think. Mm-hmm. But yeah, you should look up the Hemingway thing. I'm pretty sure it's a Hemingway system.
That guy has a ton of good quotes.
Yeah.
He's like Stravinsky for literature, you know.
Exactly. Yeah, he knew how to build a reputation in layers, not just the work.
Yeah, exactly. Well, he's all, I mean, I haven't read him in a long time, but I remember the text seeming very simple. It's that, you know, it's very hard to write like that, where it reads so easily, you know, it's actually like not so easy to write that way.
No. And that's his journalism background. I think his journalism training feeds into that very straightforward, very clear writing, but there's plenty of pulp that way, but there's not a lot of literature that way. I know that's fuzzy lines, but how do you get something that's as deep and rich as he does, but at the same time, just as you say, very easy and clear.
Mm-hmm.
Feels very natural.
You try to do the same thing in music, of course. You know, I don't think, I mean, it depends on the piece, but sometimes I will spend a lot of time on, you know, a few bars of music, but I don't want it to sound that way. I want it to sound like it was just effortlessly came out of me.
Very fluid. Yeah, exactly.
I wanted to talk about Music for Profit too.
Yes.
I'm really enjoying a lot.
Thank you.
Talk about that project.
So I did a film in 2006, I think it was, called A Scanner Darkly. And Lakeshore put out the soundtrack for that. It was a Warner Brothers movie. And years later, they surprised me with a collaboration with Fire Records in London. They and Lakeshore put out a vinyl edition of the Scanner soundtrack. And then the Fire Records folks started coming to Austin for South by Southwest, and we started doing shows together and hanging out. We did another release with them of the Hitchcock, The Lodger silent film score, and they put that out on vinyl. Started doing little projects. And then this Music for Profit is an EP where we're working towards an album, which is the first sort of full-fledged Fire Records album I've done that's originated as a Fire Records project. And James Nichols, the head of the label, is sort of acting as artistic director, producer on it. So, you know, a lot of times when you make art, well, at least I try to think of, like, who's the audience for this piece? Who do I picture being there? And that helps me know who I'm sort of having a musical conversation with. And in this one, it was James and the Fire Records team was the primary audience in my mind. So it's me figuring out what, you know, because they mostly have, like, cool, a really interesting roster, but most of it's vocal indie rock or experimental rock or in that, roughly in that vein. So me as a composer, I'm not a likely suspect to do something on their label. It's like trying to figure out what it is that makes sense for them to have me on the label and exploring that part of my work. And what is it that gets them excited? So I sent them folders and folders of sketches. And then we picked a handful, maybe seven tracks. So we said, these are the ones to develop. And so then I brought those to fully recorded versions. And then they brought on Peter Talisman, who are sort of a experimental folk duo, mixer, producer, players that came on board as creative producers, not just mixing the album, but actually like adding layers and just re-envisioning some of the pieces, almost like remixers combined with the mixer producer. And so this one, there's sort of one main track, Prophet Harmonic, that turned into Linger for Science and all these other tracks that we've been doing, where I did a couple versions and they did some wild remixes of, and then put that together into this EP. So it was a sort of a slow, long collaborative process to get these four tracks building towards the album.
Thank you.
So how did you feel about all of your material being remixed like that? It must have been pretty.
I love it. I like collaborating a lot, and we're starting with raw materials that I've made, and it was fun to hear what they did with it. There was one track, there were some tracks that they did and like, oh yeah, that sounds great, and we're sort of done. And then there were one or two where we really went back and forth a lot, because they added a bunch of stuff that I loved, and then they didn't feature other sections that I thought were important musically. And so we gradually went back and forth until we, James and Peter Talisman and I, were all really happy with where we got to on the mix. So it was deeply collaborative and in an exciting way. I'm used to collaborating across mediums where people have lots to say about what my music does or doesn't do, whether it's film or TV or dance or theater. But I don't do it. And of course, the people I play with also, especially live, they improvise a lot too. So there's that. But I've never worked with this collaborative, creative producer role. And that was a fun change. You know, I like collaborating. So, you know, ultimately in the end, I get veto power. I also want James and White to have veto power. Like, I want him to be excited about where the album ends up. So as long as we get to the point where both of us are happy, I love hearing what people are doing as far as remixing.
Yeah, and it really seems like there's so much creativity on the production end nowadays. I mean, you know, it used to be you go to the studio, they produce the album, and there always was creativity and input. But I mean, they're you know, the producers are basically another creator at this point, you know.
Absolutely, yeah. And Peter Talisman were especially they especially large role in that way on this one.
Oh, what a
It's interesting too, because I mean, you know, the traditional composer role is like, you know, it is kind of one person's vision. Like, this is the music, and the other people play it. And you've done that, but you've also played in bands, you know, where the music is written more collaboratively. So, I mean, it seems like an interesting dichotomy, you know, in a way where you're drawing from both backgrounds.
Yeah, I like the full spectrum. I do projects where I have 100% artistic control, and I, you know, either can even play every note, but also or edit every note or just choose everything. All the way over to a film where ultimately I don't have any authority at all. I create until the person who has the vision for the whole thing, the director, until they're happy. And so all these other projects fall somewhere in that spectrum, you know, and this one's, I mean, I have a lot of artistic control over the album, but they have these heavy duty collaborators, and I want their artistic voice to come through. I mean, to me, that's what like Duke Ellington or great collaborators, what Duke would do is hire players who could do things he could not, you know. From the very beginning, Bubber Miley was the hot trumpet player, and Duke couldn't really, he was dapper, he was elegant, didn't fit his image or his playing to be the hot player. But Bubber Miley could be the hot player and bring that. So he could incorporate the style that was popular at the time that made sense to put in his band and empower that person to be that presence without him having to. And so throughout his career, he surrounded himself with people who could do things that he couldn't, but they were in the context of his vision and his art. And that I really like doing that. I love playing with players who are better at their instruments than I am at mine, but putting them into the framework that I'm creating.
Yeah, I was thinking those guys, you know, the Duke Ellington band, they spent so much time on a bus together too, you know. So some of the songs have like five co-writers on them because they wrote it on the bus, you know, which is a really cool thing to think of.
It's amazing. What it's inspiring.
Do you feel like as a composer, I mean, what do you want to do that you haven't done? Like, what's a, you know, that's a weird question, but.
It's a good question. I mean yes, doing things I haven't done is sort of the top of the list all the time. One thing I've done very little is installation work, sound sculpture, that kind of thing. We were just talking, a designer and I, about the Lamont Young installation in New York. So that's something I think would be a lot of fun to do. And I've done a lot of live performance in reacting to art at art museums and art galleries. But I've done almost no, maybe for theater here and there, I've done some installation style stuff, but that's something I'd like to dive into more deeply.
Yeah, I've never done that either. I think that's obviously a really interesting thing because you know, it's very, it's, I mean, music is temporal, of course, but an installation, it depends. Everyone's going to experience it differently. It's going to be, you know, it's a totally different kettle of fish.
Exactly. So I'm just trying to, you know, it's on a sort of project shelf, like idea shelf, like who's the right partner for that, and what does that look like?
What kind of sound, like if you did a sound installation, would you be looking, you know, there's so many ways to do it. It could be a botanical garden, it could be a museum, it could be, you know, what kind of place do you think would inspire you?
I mean, any of the, but I love gardens, and doing a garden collaboration has been pretty high on my list, and trying to figure that out. But I also like those rooms in museums where it's speakers and everything's black, and just you close your eyes and experience that. So I think both of those, something that's like part of a visual experience and inspired by that, like a garden, and then something that's more pure sonic experience, where you're surrounded by amazing speakers and feel the subwoofers underneath you and all that. And so I think both of those have a strong appeal for me.
So what are some projects they're in the works for the next year or so?
The trying to finish up this album. So we started with Music for Profit as an EP and like working towards an album with that. Just got new mixes of that, so that's in progress. We just finished this Poe, Edgar Allan Poe ballet. So that premiered this weekend, but I haven't finished the album. So I think we want to do some more recordings and then later in the year release a recording of that. I'm writing music for the Eclipse. We have the Eclipse coming through just soon, like 2 weeks from today, actually, I think. And so that's for a 12-piece ensemble. I'm writing new music for the Eclipse. I'm trying to make sort of a Texas chamber big band, so it's got pedal steel, but it's got string quartet, it's got horns.
That's all the time we have on the program. Thanks so much to Graham Reynolds for being a great guest and writing amazing music. Relevant Tones is a production of Access Contemporary Music, a nonprofit with the mission of providing equitable access to the transformative power of music making. Find out more at acmusic.org. I'm going to go out now with another piece from Music for Profit. This is part two, An Endless Tower. On behalf of Relevant Tones, I'm Seth Bosted. Thanks so much for listening.